Session number 16716, Canon Gervais Markham Real 8.
Canon Markham Real 8.
Can we go back to Geel again, Canon?
Yes.
This was a particularly unpleasant action, and you were with the RAP post. You found that was where you basically were at every...
That was the only thing that a chaplain could do in the middle of the night when an action was going on. People were fighting outside, not very far away, but you had to be somewhere, and the RAP was in a barn. Hadn't got any lights on, but except for we could provide ourselves, but casualties were being brought in there. The MO was treating them, and I talked to them on stretchers just to encourage them and to feel somebody was taking an interest in them, and was there anything I could do? Could I write to their nearest and dearest to say they were alive and that sort of thing? And did this in the middle of the night while the battle was going on outside.
After Geel, where did you go?
Then we went on steadily till we got to Holland, to Nijmegen, and onto what was called the island, that low-lying area between the Waal and the Rhine. And the exciting part, I remember, was on that Sunday morning when we were in Netherlands, and we suddenly saw an enormous fleet of airplanes coming across the sky from England. We didn't know what the point of it was, but at that time, but it was, of course, the parachute regiment dropping on Arnhem, which was only just a few miles ahead of us, but the other side of the Rhine. And we were waiting in our side of the Rhine, waiting for the news that they had captured the bridge and that the army could go forward. Some people criticized the tactics of the thing because it was so difficult to go forward. There were so few roads which led across the island and all on embankments, and it meant that there was a very considerable pressure of everybody in a queue waiting to go forward. As we know, they didn't succeed in what they were attempting to do. And so we remained stationary on the island and waited there over, perhaps not over Christmas, but some weeks, living in a farmhouse with in the company of the owners. The farm family themselves, of course, were very unwilling to leave their house to the mercies of foreign troops, and so they lived in the house. They lived in the cellar, I think. We lived on the front first floor as our regimental headquarters, and we fraternized with them as much as we could. They were very anxious to see, of course, that their property was not destroyed. Meanwhile, our troops, the infantry, were posted in various dugouts and things round about in this low-lying country. As I remember, I made myself popular. It was a wonderful fruit-growing area, and there were the best apples that I've ever known anywhere, much better than even than English Cock's apples. But they'd all been blown off the trees by gunfire, and these millions of apples were lying about all over the place in the orchard, and I used to take buckets full of them and take them round to outposts who didn't happen to be in an orchard and hadn't got any apples. We lived on these lovely apples for several weeks, enjoying them.
It was a particularly wet area, wasn't it?
Yeah, very wet.
The troops must have been in quite difficult situations.
Well, yes. I suppose it was, but after all, we'd been in very dry areas before, and in this sort of wet areas, you didn't complain too much. There was nothing to do about it. We had to stay there and waited till we didn't know what was going to happen, whether we were going to go in, on, across the Rhine into Germany or what. As you may have heard, we were called the British Liberation Army, but we all said BLA really stands for Burma Looms Ahead. We were all very much afraid of what the future. We could see that Germany was about to be defeated, but we knew that was not the end of the war. Then we got the order for the division to return to England. We were all very thankful, of course. At least, with a certain amount of doubt about the future, at least we knew that these infantrymen were not going to have to cross the Rhine and to invade Germany, they'd been in so many battles, these were the survivors, like Ian English, who'd won an MC in three different campaigns, and there were a few other officers who'd been through the whole thing. A few men, but of course, over all these times, the casualties had been very large, and there weren't very many men who actually survived to go through the whole thing. I reckon that in Normandy, the average, when reinforcements came out of young officers, take the pace of casualties, their expectation of staying there was about a fortnight. The mess was changing the whole time. You had three colonels in a month at one time, I think. So that it was like, as far as pastoral ministry was concerned, it was operating on a moving platform. The people were changing the whole time. It was just a core of the real regulars who went through and kept the whole thing together.
Well, many of the drafts, the manpower shortage was coming quite acute November of 1944, when you were on the island. Where were the drafts coming? Were they coming out of corps and other regiments, or even non-infantry sources?
What we reckoned was, when we were sent back to England, it was to liberate the anti-aircraft gunners around the country who, after all, had not got much to do for the last 6 months because they went in more air raids that time, to train them to be infantrymen to finish off the war. So we got back to Yorkshire, where we were, Skipton and Keithley, and our job, as far as we could make out, was to train inexperienced soldiers of how to be infantrymen. Germany was just being finished, but we knew there was Japan ahead, and we very much devoutly hoped that we would not be asked to go and fight Japan. Thought we'd done our stuff.
So in England you were in a training situation, as you say, and you were getting lots of young people coming through. Yeah. What was their quality like compared with your experience of those men you'd been with?
Their quality was, of course, they were inexperienced. Being trained as infantrymen, I don't remember them being particularly noteworthy. My job was not to train other people. I was with the DLI who had come back, who were really waiting in England till they could get demobbed at the end of the war. What I did, in fact, apart from taking services on Sunday, I did an awful lot of Padre's hours at that time. It was the recognized thing, to keep people occupied. It was a great opportunity this was not just a voluntary. They were on parade. It was part of their training, and you would find 40 or 50 men at a time in a barrack room or somewhere, and you got an hour with them. This was a terrific opportunity, and I developed a technique of discussion groups, about the point of the war and after the war situation, and then religion and Christianity, the gospel, and you could make that hour extremely interesting if you had any sort of technique. I had been, as I say, I, I'd been a teacher in a school in Jerusalem, so I'd had 2 years of classroom experience, and I had my platoon sergeant experience of standing up. I wasn't afraid of standing in front of a group of people and getting in charge of them, you know, and getting on top of them for an hour. So that it was a great opportunity for me to do those padre's hours. I enjoyed them, and I think the men enjoyed them too, because they could say what they like. It was not like in front of the commanding officer, who if they said something out of turn, could put them on the charge. I was there as the padre, and they knew that it was not a matter of regimental discipline. It was a matter of interest. They were interested.
Did this give you an insight into their hopes and expectations when the war ended?
It was obviously socialism was coming in. They were all tired of being ordered about and being under discipline. They wanted liberty, they wanted freedom to make their own decisions. They wanted to... they had great respect for Churchill as the man who won the war, and there was no doubt about that, that he was the great hero who had brought us through. They dissociated him from what you might call them in authority. They wanted to be governed by us, that is why the great political revolution in that election took place.
Were they concerned, any of them, that it might be like the First World War, the land fit for heroes that didn't turn out that way?
Yes. Well, there was always that fear, but we had the, what is that wonderful, not the report that came out of the social equality with all...
Beveridge report.
The Beveridge report is what I'm thinking of, yes. And, of course, I had lots of padre's hours about that and about the way in which we could govern ourselves and the hopes and fears that we could put into practice all the things that we were really wanting, how, in fact, it was going to work out. We were all wanting the same thing. It wasn't surprising, really, that they wanted to change in the government they'd had.
Mm-hmm. I've meant to ask you this for some time, but I've kept it till the end. We've talked a great deal about your activities with the people that you're with from in various places. Were you involved particularly in the infantry situation with men who were receiving mail from home which was shattering their lives, their wives?
Yes, from time to time that situation did come up.
How did you deal with that?
Occasionally a man would be sent home on compassionate leave. He had to solve his own problem. But, of course, nobody can solve a problem between a man and his wife. It's got to be done by themselves. You may give people good advice, say you ought to stick together, but you can't make people love each other if they don't want to. You can't make people live together if they don't want to. My contribution in that way was different, presumably. For example, I have officiated at the weddings of, I think, about over 2,000 people in the course of my life, you see. Now, each one has been a separate couple. Each couple I have interviewed personally before the marriage. Each one I have discussed marriage and asked them if they really mean what they are about to promise, and they have always said. In each case, they have answered yes. In many cases, their parents have been divorced and separated, and I've seen these families at the wedding, when I give them my address in the course of the wedding, and known that although the people there may have parted, these two have told me that they themselves want it to be different, and they want to stick together for the rest of their lives. My hope that has been, although I cannot prevent people splitting if they want to split, I cannot make people love each other, yet I have done my best to help well over 2,000 couples to see marriage as it ought to be and to start in the right frame of mind.
Did you experience any tragedies for men doing something to themselves because of the situations they found themselves in vis-a-vis army and home? Not all of them could get home, of course, to do anything about it.
I don't remember any particular. I remember a young man, quite a lad, wanting to be to desert. He was put on a charge. He couldn't face any more of enemy fire. It was only in the gunners. It wasn't as serious as all that, but he was in the position. But he said, I will not go back to that gun again. See? And, of course, Sergeant Miller was saying, you will, you're under orders. And he was put under arrest for the colonel. The colonel couldn't make any difference. I remember going to talk to him to see if I could make any difference. And I remember saying, look, in the First World War, this is a question of cowardice. And if you are a coward and you're deserting, you are liable to be shot. You wouldn't want that sort of thing to happen to you. It didn't make any difference whatever to him, because he said, you can take me away, you can send me, put me in prison. I'd much rather be in prison than anywhere near that bloody gun. What more can you say? Yeah.
Is there a limit to a man's courage?
Yes, but in fact... it's not something that appears very often in the gunners. Of course, it is not such a dangerous situation, and so I don't remember, apart from that one incident, I don't remember of anybody who was terrified of being in action with his gun. And in Normandy, with the infantry, things were going too quickly for... anything like that to happen. There would be, I suppose, opportunities for a man not to make certain he didn't get into that situation rather than to let it happen at the last minute. I don't remember anybody suddenly sort of shouting, oh, I can't stand it any more of this, I'm running away.
Until you came out of the army, did you stay with the Durhams right up to that point?
Ah, yes. To finish off the story, yes, when we were in Yorkshire, there came the moment when VE Day was announced. I have a lovely photograph of laying a wreath on the war memorial in Keighley with three of Ian English and one or two others and myself standing there, feeling this is the end of the war, and thinking these men, my goodness, what they've been through, much more than I have. And then the great triumphant climax was marching through York to a service in York Minster. This was something that really was a wonderful climax. We had followed the TT signs through the desert, through Sicily, through, and to see these little weather-beaten TT signs on the pavement through York and following them, it was became very emotional. Really. That really this was the end of the road, that we'd followed the TT signs all this way, and now we'd come to victory. And that was the real climax of my military service. I suppose I was demobbed shortly after.
We demobbed in the same way as everyone else was demobbed.
Oh, yes.
Same procedure.
Yes, I remember going to and choosing a lovely pinstripe suit and a bowler hat and a pair of black shoes. And yes, it was a very smart suit. I wore it for years afterwards. I remember then I went to a parish in Lancashire, in Burnley, and the we had a men's Bible class on Sunday afternoon. I remember appearing the first time. I said, I will wear my bowler hat for this to show I really have been demobbed.
What date were you demobbed?
In the middle of 1945, August, I think. I was married August the 29th to this girl that I'd met had been a Wren. She'd arrived back in England, and I managed to track her down. And so That was the beginning of a long and happy marriage. I was still in uniform. She was still in uniform at Oran, but we got married in a village church in Norfolk. And I was still married. We went back to Yorkshire. They had a flat in Harrogate for a time, for a few weeks, till I was actually demobbed at York.
What was your worst moment in the forces?
The worst moment of being near death was that incident at Montpensier that I just described. I can't say that. Depends what you mean by worst. Do you mean what I disliked most, or what was most dangerous, or what I just didn't want to do, or most disastrous? What have you in mind?
I could say all of them.
Could say all of them, yes. No.
The killing and the death, obviously, was
yes. The most unpleasant things were picking up the bodies of one's friends and putting them in a blanket and having to bury them. Perhaps is worth adding to that is that you develop a skin, a hard skin, without which you couldn't continue at all. I noticed this. It lasted for 2 or 3 years in civilian life afterwards. You become impervious to emotion because you cannot carry on if you become emotional or sentimental about situations of that kind. Do things. I remember that incident in Sicily when we suddenly came under rifle fire and we all got down from our vehicles and I followed this soldier running across the field and I stumbled over body and there I found Lieutenant Whittaker, who'd been a friend of mine for a long time, and just in that last second he'd got killed. What did I do? I didn't start bursting into tears. I pinched his watch, I emptied his pockets into my own went on to see what had happened to the other ones, you see. 12 hours later, I came back to find his body and get it buried. But you couldn't say, oh, no, he's killed. And, you know, you didn't think in that way. You think of what you had to do, and you got on with it without being sentimental about it.
Looking back again over the war, is there anything that's good in the human situation? Is there anything that's good that shines through?
Oh, yes, must be, or people wouldn't have regimental reunions as they do so vividly at Durham, how many people value them. I find it a great source of pride that I am invited to take part in the officers' reunion of 151 Brigade. It happens every year, and they invite attached officers like MOs and chaplains, you see, who've been served with 151 Brigade, and I regard it as a great privilege to be able to be associated with these men or stand in the college at Durham in September when these old bodies are marching round and think, those are the people who won the war. They were the people who were the spearhead of fighting the enemy, or the survivors of them anyway. I'm very proud to be associated with the men who had the courage to do these wonderful things that they did.